Great regulation.
Want to be Sue or you want to be Steve?
Polices. So now that everyone is actually in your squad. Jane.
Okay. Thank you, Hans. Hello, everybody. Today we're back to continuing our discussions from the December meeting on rate regulation. And I have been sitting in through the last session on complexity and feeling quite uncomfortable sitting here now. But I will try and simplify things as best I can in a complex world. I'll keep the tee-up very short because I appreciate we're running late. So if I miss anything in the tee-up, please do come back to me and ask questions, but I'll keep it as short as possible. At the previous meeting, we were looking at some descriptions of the features or characteristics of rate regulation that we believe distinguish rate regulation from some general commercial activities, and using that description to look at the asset and liability definitions in the conceptual framework to see whether those special features of rate regulation do create special economic conditions that perhaps do create additional assets and liabilities that perhaps should be recognised but we don't currently. And so I appreciate that there's two areas of complexity there. One is the actual rate regulation and the features themselves, and the other one is the statement of financial presentation approach. So this time round, we're shifting our emphasis slightly, and we have produced in the papers, particularly papers 3C and 3D, a revised description of rate regulation and the particular features that we're told create these special economic conditions that maybe are not represented faithfully within current IFRSs. And we're going to take those revised and refined descriptions, and instead of taking a statement of financial position approach, we're looking for the time being at a performance or a revenue approach, which was one of the requests we got in the December meeting. Before we get into the papers, I just want to highlight a couple of features. One is that we are very still early in the process, so we are trying to develop a discussion paper. We're not trying to finalise a model for accounting for these special features of rate regulation. The approach that we're trying to take in the discussion paper is to simplify these characteristics, these features, and we appreciate some of them where we talk about there's a monopoly situation, customers don't have much choice about whether to buy the rate regulated goods or services, etc. May seem to be slightly simplified assumptions and simplified descriptions, but the reason we've developed that strategy is to try and identify the big picture, develop our thought processes, and then if we need to, we can start introducing the additional complexity later when we start relaxing some of those fairly strict assumptions. We use those descriptions in papers C and D, 3C and D, to form the basis of paper 3E, where we are looking at the revenue model that's been developed in the forthcoming standard revenue from contracts with customers. And a couple of things I think I need to mention straight away. One is we're not proposing to amend the forthcoming revenue standard even before it's been issued. That would introduce complexity that's totally avoidable. One of the reasons we're not suggesting that at all is that some people are in the camp that we don't need to modify the revenue model that's in that forthcoming standard, which perhaps is Hans's suggestion earlier. In paragraph 8 of paper 3E, we do mention that some people would argue that the main revenue generating activity in a rate regulated entity is to deliver those regulated goods and services to the end users, to the customers. And it's that relationship and that revenue generating activity that we should be accounting for, and we can do that quite simply by looking at the price per unit for those goods and services multiplied by the volume of those goods and services that we deliver, and that's our answer. And it's very simple and it's straightforward, and I'm sure IFRS 15, as it's going to become, would fit that model. The problem is, though, we've been regularly told that's too simplistic an approach, because rate regulation is more complicated than that, and there are lots more activities that the entity is required to carry out that back up the delivery of those regulated goods and services. And the rate regulation is designed to manipulate the cash flows that relate to all of those different types of activities. And the difficulty we have is the main source of cash inflow to the rate regulated entity is the cash received from those consumers for delivering those regulated goods or services, but that cash inflow covers a lot more activities. And in paper 3E, we've tried to take the revenue model in the forthcoming standard, highlight the bits that we think have some possibilities maybe as a starting point for developing a revenue model for rate regulated activities, but we also highlight lots of the complex areas where the model in the forthcoming standard doesn't neatly fit to the issues that are raised in rate regulation. So just on that point, I'm going to stop here. I'm going to assume everybody's read all of the papers, but before we perhaps dive into paper 3E, it may be worth, if anybody's got any questions on the description of rate regulation and those distinguishing features that we describe in papers 3C and 3D, if they want to ask those questions first and clarify any uncertainty before we dive into paper 3E.
Kevin?
Jane, just on the methodology of trying to concentrate on the simplest, most straightforward case first, is the discussion paper then going to widen? Will it cover competitive rate-regulated entities?
I think, Kevin, that we'll touch on those, and it's perhaps a question that we'll ask rather than diving into it in the discussion paper. One of the reasons why I'm somewhat reluctant to get into the competitive environment, because I know a lot of utilities, which are the most common example of rate-regulated entities, when you get into the more competitive end of that market, the distinguishing features or the demand that we're getting from the industry lessens, because it isn't distinguishing from the particular special economic conditions that we're constantly being told about. So the more competitive you are, the softer the rate regulation. In some cases, the rate regulation is withdrawn altogether. If there is some regulation, it's commonly what we've called market regulation within the papers, where it tends to focus just on a price cap, which says the price per unit is set at a maximum level, but there's still lots of things you can do to get a competitive advantage and perhaps knock out some of your competitors, so you can earn as much revenue or as much profit as you can possibly earn, and we've still got that little protection in for the customer on the price per unit. So at the moment, it's trying to focus on what we think is the strongest case, the characteristics that we're being told by the industry and by analysts, those are the strongest features to focus on, and we'll perhaps ask a question, how far do we soften those features if we then come to develop any specific guidance?
A general remark I'd like to make, and this might not resonate a lot with those of you who have only thought about the private sector. We set standards for both sectors, and so when the revenue standard comes out, we are trying to bolt on to the back of that what you do when you're not dealing with an exchange contract with a customer. Because in the public sector, you get mixed transactions, non-reciprocal transactions. and so forth. So you can't work off the customer contribution amount in the same way as you can in the main model. So we're trying to deal with that. So in a sense, what you're trying to do now is create the other part of revenue when you're not dealing with customers, with contracts with customers, but only driven from a particular type of transaction, which is relatively narrow compared to all of the other non-reciprocal transactions that go on, some of which are vaguely interpreted into IAS 20, but in the public sector are rife.
I mean, that may be something that from the responses we get to the discussion paper come out, because of course what we're talking about with rate regulation is primarily transactions or relationships with the government, as the rate regulator is acting on behalf of the government. And again, one of the simplifying assumptions we've made for the purpose of our discussion so far is that we're not going to bring IS 20 and government grants into play just yet. We're focusing on that strongest case scenario where the cash inflows are coming from the end users, from the consumers. But we have in the back of our mind, we do need to touch on the areas where the consumers perhaps can't afford to pay for all of the different types of activities, and the government then needs to find an alternative source of funding and could introduce subsidies or other types of government grants and assistance. But the more complexities we bring into the initial argument, the harder it is to see the big picture and actually develop a constructive discussion, because everybody's focusing on the difficult issues on the edges and can't focus on what perhaps is a more simple scenario that we can at least draw some principles and approaches from.
Russ?
So specifically on memo 3C, paragraph 46A, we had passed around this memo to others. And I think there was a concern about focusing on little or no competition, in that there may be some scenario where there is little or no competition, but it's not because of a public policy or a regulatory reason. And so some people thought it might be better to focus or emphasize inelastic demand, that is demand unaffected by prices, or the framework in and of itself, the regulatory framework, is designed to limit competition for public policy reasons. You don't have multiple telephone poles on both sides of the streets. But just again, just emphasizing what you mean by little or no competition.
Yeah.
Other than that, we thought the other criteria in paragraph 46 was very, very good starting point.
Thank you.
Well, I think it's a great lateral thinking to go the revenue recognition route rather than perhaps the cost deferral route. I suppose my big concern, though, is it's going to be very hard dividing out those companies who you want to account in a completely different way from everybody else. So in the UK, for example, power companies, which compete fiercely and have no rate regulated, they still have quite a lot of public service obligations which the government impose on them. So, for example, the electricity and gas companies have to help consumers without insulation put insulation in. So now they would very much like to somehow spread that over evenly over the revenue that they're generating, but they're not allowed to under IFRS. We've had a recent discussion with this. So are we saying, therefore, that if you're in a country which is rate regulated and you have those public service obligations, you count one way, and if you're not, you account in a different way? And I just think the more you get into the detail, the more difficult it's going to be to distinguish a lot of these things from other companies. So I'm afraid I'm not convinced about the revenue model, and I would, I think, prefer to go to some sort of cost model. I also have a concern that we're confusing, in some cases, cash flows with revenues and assets. So the regulator allows a company to bump up its prices early on to finance some new, I don't know, power station or whatever. That's cash. What are they meant to do? Are they meant to defer the revenue and allocate it against the cost of the asset? I mean, you're getting into totally different accounting for some narrow group to everybody else, and I don't know how this is going to help anyone understand their financial position. So my last point is, so I would go the cost deferral route. I don't actually mind if that doesn't meet the definition of an asset, because you could almost treat it like a cash flow hedge. We're already talking about OCI being a bridge between what looks right in the performance statement and what looks right on the balance sheet. I'd almost rather use OCI to balance out some of these things rather than end up with a totally different revenue position to everybody else.
I think, I suppose the first point to note is that the ISB haven't actually concluded on any of this.
It is,
yeah, it's still raising the question at this stage. In the context of the whether it should be revenue or whether it should be cost, again, that's a very important question that we'll need to draw out through the DP. One of the reasons for looking at it from the revenue point of view is that one of the roles of the regulator is often to stabilise the rate, the price per unit, and to apply a smoothing mechanism, which comes back to Russ's point about the framework is important as well. It's not just whether there's little or no competition, is there a framework behind it? And one of the issues, and the reason we raised the example in paper 3E, with if the rate is bumped up to provide some funding to build the power station or whatever it is, the problem we've got is that when the power station then comes online and we start selling the electricity generated by that power station, the price that we can charge per unit of electricity is restricted because the regulator says you've already had some of the cash up front that relates to that activity. So it is a manipulation of the selling price and the revenue, not just of the cash flows. But you're right, I don't know what the answer is here. We're kind of throwing out questions and we'll see what we get back.
Thank you. Basically, we support the ISB staff's proposal to keep narrow focus based on a simpler set of fact patterns. At the initial stage of analysis, it would be more efficient to give a narrow scope approach, and once conceptual issues are addressed, you can broaden the scope to identify if the initial analysis would differ based on the new set of fact patterns. Regarding the revenue recognition standard, we understand using a hypothetical contract between the entity and the rate regulator, but we are not supportive because you are not successful in this hypothetical contract in finding a performance obligation to transfer goods or services from the entity to the rate regulator. Also, it is dangerous to use revenue recognition standard in this way, so that might lead the for the other person to use or interpret revenue recognition standards as they like. Thank you.
Now, in our meeting of consultative program of standard setters, we have considered those papers, and the view of the group was that the set of criteria that are proposed to be the basis for discussion paper, that was in fact agreed, with the recommendation though that you develop some reasoning arguments around what you call market regulation in itself would not qualify or would not be part of the scope. So that the discussion can take place indeed, and that you can have some feedback on whether some adjustments to those criteria should be had. On the revenue model route, there is support to investigate this possible avenue. So. Roger was missing in our discussion the other day, so we will have further debate. We also, however, emphasize the need to analyze carefully who controls the assets which are eventually constructed out of the requirements for a certain level of capacity for restoring after a storm or whatever. And that, of course, will bring you nearer to considering what you have already said you would do, the possible overlaps or non-overlap with IFRIC 12, so the concessions.
Maybe it's a minor point, but on paragraph 13 of 3C, you mentioned that we have to focus on the clear case where, in which there is a single supplier. There's so many cases of rate regulation that there are several suppliers.
Well, this is again the in a geographical area, there's often only one supplier, but you're right, in some there is more than one, and in some countries the governments have got a policy of trying to introduce additional suppliers to introduce a more competitive market. And it is an area where, like I say, it's the more suppliers you introduce, the more complex the issue is. So that's why we just like to focus. There are lots and lots and lots of examples where it is one single supplier.
Yeah,
so
but there's a lot of examples.
There certainly are, but I think to try and get the discussion going forward, I think it's easier if we can try and focus on the single supplier scenario and then broaden it out to what happens if you start to introduce additional suppliers.
Kim?
Thanks, Hans. Yeah, I certainly think that, Jane, as you've said, to get the project going, I would support having a fairly narrow focus, because I think what will be very interesting is to see how all of these features then will interact with the definition of assets and liabilities, etc. So in other words, you know, things like, for example, the fact that there is only a single supplier, is that the key, you know, element for now saying, well, because of that, because there is no other competition, I do have, you know, a right and I do have an obligation that meets the definition. Whereas, as you then say, if you do bring in the other elements, or you know, other schemes where there is greater competition, etc., does that all of a sudden affect the conclusion when one applies that those features against the definition of the elements in the financial statement? So absolutely agree that you have to have a starting point as narrow as possible, I think, to test a lot of these elements against the definitions in the conceptual framework. Just on applying the revenue model, yeah, I actually think for me, what would be interesting, in a way, it's I suppose implied, is that there is only one source of cash flows. So I guess for me, if you do apply it, well, I think it's going to reflect how the rate regulated activity, a rate regulated entity, should recognise its revenue. And I think that, I suppose maybe I'm a little bit sceptical as to whether or not it's really going to say that there is another source of revenue from the activities that the rate-regulated entity seems to apply. Because I think, you know, as I think it was Roger mentioned, that in a lot of industries, there could be requirements imposed on those entities in terms of, you know, if you want to operate in this industry, these are some of the things that you need to do. And whether or not those really result in the transfer of goods and services, and also the receipt of consideration, because as we say, the only source of that is from the customers buying the ultimate good or service. So, as I say, maybe not to sound too sceptical, I think I struggle to see how looking at the revenue is going to really result in there being additional revenue or different revenue, or if so, well then how do they then recognise the revenue from the transfer of goods or services to the customer, i.e. if in a particular period they've transferred those goods and services and the consideration they received was that price times the quantity. On what basis will it be clear that, well, actually, no, that isn't the revenue from transferring those goods and services? So I think that is going to be the challenge, yeah. But I certainly think that it is good to see how does the project on revenue, how should it be applied by a rate-regulated entity, even, you know, in just recognising any of its revenue, not necessarily the additional bit or whatever to do with the regulator.
Anna? Yes, well, in general terms, we agree with the approach of analyzing the different features of different rate-regulated activities and then see and then analyze the revenue recognition and see if it fits under IFRS 15 or we should go to another revenue recognition criteria.
Clemens?
Yeah, the general comment is agree that if this project is going to proceed, it should be kept on a narrow scope, like the others were saying. Two specific comments. One member actually mentioned that there are other rate-regulated activities which do not meet the proposed criteria and suggest to evaluate whether regulatory assets and liabilities can still exist, particularly in consideration of the conditions stated in paragraph 46 and 47 of 3C, and whether to explore. And another specific comment is made by a member is not very clear to differentiate market regulation from competitive situations such as oligopoly, and suggest to add more sort of explanations, if possible, illustrations, what element are able to tell them apart.
Okay, Jane.
Jane, do you have a feel for how many countries you're capturing and how many you're not capturing?
We've tried to ask around. We've got our consultative group who looked at the papers 3C and 3D, which is the descriptions, because we are quite conscious we don't want to make this so narrow that we don't capture anybody or we only capture one or two. And our consultative group have got representatives from lots of different countries. EFRAG have got a similar working group who also, I think, some of the members there have looked at these papers. So we do feel that we would capture entities from a reasonable width of different countries, but we haven't got the empirical evidence to say exactly which countries and how many. But the feedback that we're getting from the consultative groups is that these criteria are okay to capture enough countries to make it worthwhile pursuing this or capture enough different regulatory regimes and entities. And then again, by testing the criteria and how tight or how loose that they can be, that will help us gain more information about the population it might be affecting.
I think I'm going to have trouble convincing the Australian market to pay much attention to the DP because they'll see themselves as pretty much scoped out.
I think one of the purposes of the DP is try and work out the scope, and that's why we want to ask the questions about the criteria and how tight or how loose those criteria need to be. Because one of the problems with the old project was it was a very narrow scope and it only captured a very limited population, and we don't want to fall into the same problems with that project, and that's why we've gone back a step. It's not very often we have any exposure draft and then we go backwards to do a discussion paper, but we've done that this time because the scope, I think, is probably the most difficult aspect of this project, because it's identifying what are these characteristics and what do they lead to. And I think then the accounting, I'm not going to say it's easy, but I think the accounting will drop out a lot more clearly once we identify exactly what it is we're trying to account for here.
You want to continue with, many people have already referred to the revenue recognition model, but
I think generally, I know that the session is quite short, but I think we're getting a lot of good feedback, and I think it's okay. Unless people want to add additional comments, I'm quite happy to finish on the time.
Yeah.
The only option on the revenue, we did an analysis. We do have these transactions in the U.S. That you have in the paper, and we did go through the analysis to determine in our conforming amendments if we felt that the regulator was party to the contract with the customer, and concluded they would not be under the revenue recognition project. That said, I encourage you to continue on what you're thinking about in the DP to see if it should be depicted as revenue, and if so, should it be presented separate and apart from other transactions with customers?
I think one of the issues, and I think it touches on one of the points that Kim made,
a lot of this is the time, is it revenue is one question, and the timing of it is another. So there are some aspects that I know talking to various people have picked up on to say some of it sounds a little bit like self-insurance, so particularly with the storm damage where you're getting money in advance, so is that deferred revenue because it's for future performance? Yeah. Also, in that similar context, could it be something like a warranty type of approach, which is dealt with in the forthcoming revenue standard, that you have guaranteed to provide a certain level of service and people are paying now for that continuing level of service or even an improved level of service? So part of the revenue you're collecting today, it could be possibly seen as a warranty, so you just strip that little bit of the revenue out and reflect it in the future. It's a suggestion. I'm not sure how far it goes. Another suggestion is, I think it's IFRIC 18 on contributions from customers when we're talking about expanding the network or improving the network. If some of the revenue now the regulator has built in to say that's a contribution to building additional capacity, do we delay the recognition of that element of the revenue to that future point in time in a similar way we do with IFRIC 18? So a lot of it, I think, is timing of revenue as well as describing what we actually mean by revenue.
Harry?
I just wanted to go back on one point too. I think in particular Kevin and Roger's comments about scope. I think what we're trying to say in these papers is if this narrow population is the best argument for a special model, do you think that these characteristics support any special model? Do you think that any of these characteristics are unnecessary? And so, Kevin, you say, I think that you would have a difficult time getting people to pay attention in an Australian environment. I think I'd be interested in hearing from Australia, which may not have a number of those key characteristics, whether they think that if you have this different set, there should be a special model, or there shouldn't be, even if you have those characteristics, or they think that a special model is so necessary that any of those characteristics are not necessary. I think what we were just trying to do is say, what's the strong, the strongest case? And do you see any, if you look at it as pickup sticks, do you see any sticks that can be taken out? And really saying, what around the world do you think is necessary or supportive of a special model? Not, we think you have to have this, or we have already reached a conclusion that there should be a special model, and it's just a negotiation of who's in.
I think, posing it that way is a very good way of getting people to think about it, but I think you're going to have to be very careful in your DP using language that brings that point out.
Mm-hmm.
Because the natural reaction of our regulated entities, and we have many regulated entities, there are significant effects of regulation on cash mm-hmm. flow, but they're almost all competitive-based models these days.
Mm-hmm.
They moved on from the geographic monopoly type situations that were traditional in the US. It's not where we started, and it's not where we are now. So those people are just going to say, it's not us.
Mm-hmm.
Looks odd.
Mm-hmm. And
to get them to engage intellectually in it, you're going to have to use the DP in a fairly clever way, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And that's my concern about a narrow scope. Fine if you're in that space and you can relate it to yourself. If it looks totally different, what do you do then? Next.
Why should I care? So we have to answer the why should I care if it's narrow scope.
Roger? Just, amplification of what I was saying earlier. I mean, not only do you have these criteria, you have to prove that these criteria are unique to you and not to people outside the industry. So I think you gave another example that I picked up on reading the papers about you're allowed to charge revenue so that you can save it up, and then if there's some sort of storm or whatever, you've got that money. But then all sorts of industries, know that they have these problems from time to time, and part of their revenue, they're not saving up. But that revenue is, they're making those profit margins
to cope with rainy days. When you have the rainy day, that's when you take the charge in the income statement. Everyone thinks that's a rainy day. You don't sort of ignore this rainy day and think, well, I can now get this hidden reserve I've got tucked up. And so you really have to say what's special that it doesn't replicate. And I don't think having rainy days is special.
I think one of the arguments to say why it is special, because I accept, yeah, people, when they're doing their pricing structures, anticipate building additional infrastructure or additional PP&E, they're anticipating the rainy days. One of the features that we're told is special about rate regulation, and again, it's a question in the discussion paper, do people agree this makes it special, is if that rainy day event doesn't happen within the designated timescale, then the rate-regulated entity is forced to pull its prices down to eliminate that reserve that's been built up, which wouldn't happen in a normal type of environment. So it's all these questions, and there are lots of situations where you say, well, it's a monopoly supplier. You could have a natural monopoly supplier, but there's no rate regulation around it. So is that on its own a distinguishing feature, or do you have to have something like the regulatory framework, the pricing manipulation by the rate regulator, etc.? How many of these different features really are unique enough to support developing a special model?
Okay. Have we discussed sufficiently?
Thank you.
Yes?
I think unless anybody is desperate to continue the discussion after lunch, I think I'm good, certainly.
All right, so we pause for lunch. We reconvene 1:45.